In much of the world, politics is dominated by men. Why is this? And how might it change? Self-help groups have been strongly supported across South Asia. The theory is that if rural women meet regularly to manage small loans, they will build solidarity, recognise shared grievances, and collectively assert their priorities. But does this actually happen? And how do rural men react? Solidarity's Prilliman, a professor of political science here at Stanford, answers this precise question in her fantastic new book, The Patriarchal Political Order. Today, she joins me at the King Center on Global Development, Stanford University's research hub on global poverty and inequality. Soledad, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Honestly, I adored your book. I worship at your feet. It is a masterpiece. Congratulations.
Thank you. I cannot tell you what a treat it is to be here today to talk to you about it.
Oh, yes. Okay, right. Now, one big fact about India is that Indian women vote in droves. Mm. But then you point to a curiosity that they rarely engage politically. Tell me, what's going on?
So it's a really striking fact that, you know, women have for the last decade and even before been voting at such high rates, this, you know, almost the same as men in most elections. And what was striking to me is how at odds that often feels if you enter any political space in a rural Indian village. And when I started this project, I tried to understand the data on this. Mm. And everywhere I looked, the only data I could get was on voting. It was just about women are turning out and therefore there's no issue with women's political empowerment in India. But when you start to dig deeper, you see what you just described, that, you know, that this is not necessarily the best indicator of political empowerment if we look at women's participation in between. So to answer your question, what's going on here? The argument that I make is that we actually shouldn't see women voting as an indicator of their political agency, and we should question why they're voting in the first place. Mm-hmm. Are they voting because they want to, because they choose to, because they're choosing to express their voice in these political spaces? Or, what I see more commonly, are they voting because they're told to, because it is what is expected of them to do by mostly the men in their families? And in the data that I can collect, I see that that is what's happening far more often, not just for women, but for younger men too, anyone who's not dominant in families, that you vote because it helps the people in your family, particularly the men who hold power in the family, get what they want out of the political process.
Wow. Okay, tell me about the data you collected.
So for this, I think two pieces of data speak to this most clearly. The first is just a bunch of interviews that I did with men and women about the process of how you make political decisions. Because the reason that that interview data was so critical to me is that when you and I think about how we vote, mm-hmm. how we participate in politics, I'm assuming here, but when most of us think about this, mm-hmm. we think about just an individual making decisions on their own.
Yes.
And the process feels very just internal. Mm. You decide what you want to do and then you do it. Mm. And yet, that's not at all what emerged when I would talk to women. In fact, they would describe very little of their own internal calculus in this. And so it was only through deep conversations with them about the nature of their relationships with the home, the nature of their access outside of the home, what it looked like to discuss politics, that it wasn't just that it revealed why women vote, but it revealed something that I think is very antithetical to how we often think of politics, which is that it's not an individual decision, it's a household decision. And so that the qualitative data made that clear to me. And then I paired that with quantitative surveys to really get at this. And, you know, I want to just flag two parts of that and we should chat more. Mm-hmm. But the first is that to really understand the nature of relationships in the decision-making process, you need more than just a couple talking to a couple of people. Mm-hmm. You need to understand these relationships. And so that changed the kind of sample that I wanted to collect data on. And so what I did was I did a survey that censused all adults in a set of villages in rural Madhya Pradesh, so that I could talk to not just some women, but all women and all of the men in their households. And I can understand not just what one woman in the household thinks about her life, but the way that her husband, her father-in-law, her sister-in-law, all of these people think about their lives, and really pull out the full story. But the second thing that was hard is, you know, how do you measure these issues of agency amidst participation? And so part of the need to go and collect survey data on my own was to capture these deeper pieces of information about psychological experiences with the how you decide, not just the do you show up to vote, because that's the data we've seen before, not the how you decide to vote, who decides who you vote for, and what does that process look like?
Yes, I want to say three things. So when I was in Rajasthan, you know, I would ask people questions, you know, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? Do you like that? And so often women would just say to me, it's tradition. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, these Jat women or these Muslim women would say, you know, they weren't allowed to go to weddings. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, well, how do you feel about that? You know, and on the one hand, they'd say, well, you know, I'd like to go to a wedding. You know, that sounds like a fun party, but they're not allowed because of men's sexual possessiveness and concerns about them mixing and mingling with other men. Or the idea of men eating first, which is common across North and Central India. And you'd ask people their opinion and that's just how it is. Right? And there's this wonderful book by Deepa Narayan Chup, mm-hmm. Shush. And it's the idea that women are socialized to please others, socialized to please their in-laws, because that's what preserves and consolidates Jati solidarity and alliances. And she talks about how women never in their childhood, so this isn't just politics, this is how men and women are socialized, mm-hmm. socialized to respect and obey your parents, socialize to please your in-laws and to be accommodating and to absorb them. And so, and she talks about, you know, women, you know, it would be a very individualist thing where you're saying to a child, do you want a vanilla ice cream or a chocolate ice cream? You know, if you're not getting those kinds of choices on a day-to-day basis, if not, you're not being asked, Soledad, what do you want to do today? Soledad, what do you want to pursue and enjoy in your life? If you're continually thinking, how can I please and accommodate and serve these other people? Then that's part of your thinking process, and that gendered socialization and that gerontocratic socialization feeds in to the political domain, which you articulate so well through your qualitative research.
I think this is so important, what you're highlighting, because one of the questions that I get asked regularly is, how is it that women are told what to do? They're told to go vote. What does it mean to have agency? In this case, I'm talking about political agency, but you rightly like zoom out and see that this is not just one domain. This is agency more broadly. And, you know, the way that I think about it is that agency comes from, you know, there's two things that are operating here to constrain agency. One is what feels maybe more obvious to us when you are afraid for your safety, when you're afraid of being hurt or having arguments, you know, that's going to make it very hard to have the freedom to choose to have vanilla ice cream if you're told that having like chocolate ice or vanilla ice cream is going to lead to some sort of severe violence or backlash, which we know happens very regularly in the home. But I think that what you're highlighting is the way that agency is more deeply constrained, that in the process of socialization, patriarchy becomes internalized, where I can't imagine not having chocolate ice cream and having vanilla ice cream because I have been told over and over in my life that this is the role that I play. And we can think about this in the political domain. It is just how it is that I would vote for
the way that absolutely. You don't even consider it. Like, vanilla ice cream is what you do. So I don't want to take us too off topic, but maybe if I'm actually... So I personally don't use the concept agency because I think that people are always making choices, but the choices they pursue are shaped by their socialization and their social policing. Like, for example, you know, if you're always told that a good girl is one that obeys her in-laws and respects her parents and acts appropriately, and a bad girl, you can feel psychological guilt in being a bad girl, or that's a bad person, you know, it's disloyal or disrespectful to argue back or to stand your ground. You know, that's not a nice person and you're supposed to act in these ways. That I think that, you know, you can, you know, people are making choices, but, you know, sort of a Marxist, well, as Marx said, you know, it's shaped by your whole environment and your options and what sort of things are punished for. And so for me, I'd think about, you know, what, yes, just that you can choose and pursue and prefer a patriarchal world order. And this is like Denise Candiotti's idea, right? Bargaining with patriarchy, that sort of, you're optimizing given these constraints, right? And socialization.
You know, it's, when I think of how I conceptualize yes. agency, in some ways I don't know that it's actually that different, but I think it's worth pushing and chatting through this. When I think of what agency is, I think it's having, when making a choice, having an option set that has more than one thing. If I have only one thing in my option set, even if it's a choice, it's not an agentic choice, because either I can only imagine eating vanilla ice cream, or because I have a gun to my head and vanilla ice cream is the only thing that solves the puzzle. That said, I think where there's, you know, now we're going maybe a little off. Well, you know, one of the things that I struggled with is the difference between agency and autonomy. And, you know, the need, I still want more clarity on these terms, but the idea of what would it look like in the world that I live in? What choices am I making conditional on the world I'm in? Often we think of that as agency, versus what would it look like in a world that didn't have patriarchy, where there was no oppression or coercion? Mm-hmm. Would I still, in that world, make this choice? And to me, I think... You know, I think we can, both of those, in some ways I hear some of that in the way that you think about and are talking about this. And I think that that echoes what I see in this, because the reason I articulate this as non-agency is because when women have a different option in the data that I have, they choose a different option. So when the world changes for them, they make a different choice, which shows that the choice they were making in the first place was so deeply constrained by the socialization, the set of norms, all of the things that you're describing.
Yes, yes. So, like, going back to your point about always having a different choice, I think that Indian women do always have different choices, different, you know, various options, but there are heavy sanctions, right? So you could go be a single woman in Delhi, but then your economic options are difficult, that no one will rent to a single woman, and that it's difficult to find out a job because of discrimination, and people will question your morals and wonder what you're up to and ask, you know...
Which I would just and say, it's I'm bad not for sure your family. That's a choice, you know? Yeah, it's a choice, but it's an exceedingly hard choice.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And so in your data, in your quantitative data, you find that women say that they're more likely to follow the advice of their husbands or fathers, whereas men are saying they typically make their own.
It's interesting. What I see is that for men over the age of 40,
right,
more than 85% of them say they do what they want.
Yes.
When it comes to who they vote for. They vote for who they want to vote for, and they don't defer their vote choice to someone else. Women across the board, as well as men under the age of 40, only about 40, 45% say that they vote and behave the way that they want. And the majority of women and young men say that it's older men in the family who end up deciding who they vote for. And to me, I think that quantitative data comes to life in understanding the qualitative experience. One of the things that we asked in the interviews was we really wanted to address even what you're highlighting. What happens if you wanted something different, if you could imagine a different choice? So one of the questions was, imagine that your best friend is running for office and you want to vote for her. Uh-huh. So already saying there's a different choice, you want to make that choice, but your husband doesn't want to vote for her and doesn't want you to vote for her. What do you do? And what we see is that almost all women say they do what their husband wants, not what they would want in that circumstance. So when you even when you change the world and the choice set, they still feel like they will align with the man at home.
And I really love that you emphasize age, and I would highlight broader parallels here in terms of thinking about arranged marriage. So in a system, in a, you know, the caste system, I would suggest, depends on suppressing conjugal love, because you want filial piety, you want loyalty to the parents. And so, you know, a strong relationship between husband and wife can pull that apart, because the wife might pull you apart from your gotra, from your jati, for example. And so the wife can be a threat to that filial piety. And for that reason, conjugal love tends to be suppressed. And so in a caste system, both young men and young women don't necessarily have that freedom. And so both young men and young women are told that you know, the good son puts family first. And so, for example, even, you know, just expanding broadly, because I think it's worth understanding this, you know, in a broad context. You know, I know Indian men who had, you know, went to university in England, had jobs in London, and then their parents say, oh, you know, it's time for you to come home and run the family business. And they'll say, oh, you know, I'm not so sure. But they'll say, no, no, it's time to come home. And they do, right? So that's being a dutiful, loving, caring son. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily interpreted as coercion, it's interpreted as your responsibility, your duty, and being loving and supporting and being a good son. Mm-hmm. And people can be internalizing these ideas, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's just, you know, it's part of global cultural variation that in Europe and North America, people are much, much more individualist. And, you know, people pursue their own wants, not necessarily asking their parents what they want to consider. And so I think what you're observing in the political domain about age-based choices and variation is very similar to what we see in terms of marriage, in terms of labour markets, much more broadly. And, you know, a son may have, you know, aspirations to go off and run some company in London, but he comes back for the family business. He's putting family first, and that's internalized.
And so much of this, I mean, you highlight the role of caste and norms that in these other identity domains, you know, but part of what I think this is built on is the norm of patrilocality, you know, that you are expected to move in with your parents, with your husband's parents, the joint family norm that goes along with the nature of marital relationships upholds the system that you're supposed to care for, you know, care for parents. And, you know, just to echo what you said, I'm going to step aside from the book for a second, but I have a study that I'm, a different study that looks at the labor market that studies young men and women under the age of 25, all of whom have left home for work via a vocational training program. And what we were shocked to find is that within 1 year, every single one has returned home to the village, despite having migrated away. And for women, the vast majority said the reason was because they were called home for marriage and for, like, it was time to take care of the family. And for men, it was because they wanted to pursue financial options closer to home, which, you know, we could dig more deeply into, but probably echoes of some of the same things. So it's exactly, you know, as you're describing, there's the depth of internalization of how not just patriarchy, but patrilocality, patrilineality, all of these very strong gendered norms of existence, you know, define the option set that that people, you know, find acceptable.
Yes. And Kevan Munshi and Rosenberg, they've got a nice paper asking, you know, why is rural urban migration relatively low in India? And their argument is that if one person goes to the city, then that's signaling a lack of loyalty to the jati back in the village. And so you need to show your loyalty. So that encourages people to stay put, consolidate those caste ties. Yes.
But, you know, I'm expanding now a little bit and moving to a different piece of evidence. But I think that one of the things that emerged to me as I did this study was how so deeply intertwined caste politics and gender politics are.
Yes, for sure.
You know, when you ask, we've talked about how men often have control over women's vote choice. Mm. And so you very clearly see how information about politics passes across the genders, though through one sort of one flow. But when you look at caste dynamics and you measure political discussion, more than 95% of the people with whom people discuss politics are from the same jati or caste category. So there's these incredibly tight networks of how information flows. And so all to say, you know, I'm moving us in a different direction, but I think that part of how caste politics is maintained is by keeping the household functioning in the way that it functions as a political unit, and therefore sort of allowing for easier coordination at a caste level, which is shared by households, as opposed to creating divisions among women, divisions among the gender, say, solidarity across women that would challenge that system.
Yes, yes. And I think, and there's, have you read this book, The Indian Coffee House?
No, I haven't.
Ah, it's tremendous. Okay. It's all about the Indian coffee house during the emergency. And, you know, people would come, like, socialists, communists, you know, even a few neoliberals might go there. And it was this, like, amazing center of debate and discussions. And people would share newspapers and share what they learned. And it was a real hive of, like, I think, cross-caste, bargaining kind of activism and resistance and all kinds of different people sharing ideas. But it was only men, right?
And so, and I think, you know, that's a parallel with your research, right? And, you know, even in the cities and the urbanizing places, even when you've got this dissent, even when you've got this sort of push of doing things differently, you see these same gender dynamics come out.
You know, just to speak to this, I have a project right now in Nepal, and I was in Nepal a few months ago, and I was talking to a bunch, it's around women elected representatives, and I was talking to a bunch of women elected representatives who came out of the Maoist revolution and
right.
were part of the... Uh-huh. the Constituent Assembly. Mm. And in the very first assembly meant to draft the Constitution, the women across the parties formed a caucus for women to come together and make sure that the Constitution would reflect women's demands. And they were seen as so powerful that it got banned. And after that, no caucuses were allowed of any type. And so, which I think shows that when you see women coming together, you see that that is challenged in ways that it may not be challenged when you see men come together.
Mm. You know, Nepal is such a fascinating, and now this is a real tangent, so listeners will forgive me. So if we look at the population data on genomics, Nepalese people are like Tibeto-Burman people, and they're a distinct group from North Asia who then migrated and stayed in the Himalayas. But then, of course, they converted to Hinduism. They're culturally assimilated. They speak like an Indo-European language. And their rate of female employment is very similar to the rest of India, like it's relatively low. And so they adopted all these caste-based patriarchal ideas, whereas the Tibetan-Burman people, which remain much more culturally and linguistically isolated because of the Himalayas, have far higher rates of female employment. But the Nepalese are much more like Indians.
That's really interesting. And I mean, it's, you know, one of the things that I'm learning in this process is how similar politics also is.
Right.
How similar, you know, how similar some of the same patterns of representation exist. So I'm not so surprised to hear about this.
One thing I wanted to say about your book, which I found so refreshing and so brilliant, is that there have been many studies on gender and South Asia and politics highlighting positive effects, right? So when you have a female panchayat leader, she's more likely to register land in women's names, said Rachel Brulé. When you have a female panchayat leader, people are more likely to support gender equality, to say women can be a leader, right? So you get all these sort of positive studies and showing that when self-help groups emerge, then people are more likely to support gender equality. And I think those show positive effects, which is true, but I've always been questioning the size of those effects, because when we take a step back and look at India in the bigger picture, we see a lot of cultural continuity. And I think your book really sheds light on why patriarchy persists. So I want you to tell me, why is it that so few Indian women contract their representatives? Because this is the other part of the puzzle, right? That their political participation is very low at the village level. And what's going on there?
Yeah, and you know, it's not so different a story, and it comes, you know, to think about the very positive story that exists around women and women in politics in India. I think one of the things that this book tried to do was really demonstrate how deep
yes,
the problem
yes,
is.
Yes, yes, yes.
This isn't, you know, and my belief, and I think some of what the evidence shows, and we can talk through it, is that even when you make progress, you know, it's like one step forward, one step back, one step forward, one step back, because of how deep these, not just patriarchal norms are, but structures and institutions that can reassert themselves. So now to answer your actual question.
No, this is brilliant. This is brilliant. And I totally agree. Yes.
And so what is it? Why is it that women don't contact their leaders? Why do they not show up in these public spaces? And it's the same answer. It's that they're denied the ability to do so often. Some of that's internalized attitude. Some of it is things that we know very clearly, care burdens and higher costs to engaging in those spaces. And some of it is that, you know, the household will say, we already have someone going.
Yes.
The household's demands are already being made. Why would you, the person who has a higher resource cost to going, you have to, like, you need to care for our children and make our dinners, who has a higher social cost of going because, you know, you're going to get sanctioned for showing up in these spaces. It goes against the socialization. And who probably the institution is going to be less responsive to, because you're going to be less efficacious in making demands when it's a male-dominated space. Why would you be the person who should be the representative of our family, whereas the head of the household, the man who leads the home, can go, and if we all want the same thing anyways, he'll reflect those demands in those spaces, and we can save all of those costs that you would have incurred by just having him be the representative of the home. And so you see these households operating as pseudo-representative like institutions, but we should question whether they're sort of representative democracies. They probably aren't, you know, because what demands, well, and I think, you know, what I just want to say in addition, there's two consequences of that that are lurking behind what feels like a very rational choice. You know, I will, my life will be easier because I don't have to go make these demands. And we still get what we want. And the first is that what demands are going to get raised? You know, is it going to be the things you would raise? I mean, some of them are what the household would want. But being in a space matters for what gets articulated. And so the things that are specific to the experience of being a woman are less likely to get raised. And the second is that this catalyzes a self-perpetuating system where, well, if only men are showing up in this space, then men gain power from engaging in those spaces, building networks, getting information that they can then reassert themselves as the dominant political figure of the household. And so it starts to become this equilibrium where women are apolitical, despite what they may or may not want to do, and men are the political figures of the family. And all of this creates both of the dynamics where you would have women not showing up in these public spaces that where it might be costlier to attend, showing up to vote, but not voting in the way that they might want, when all the information they get is coming through the male head of household, or when they're told, here's how you're supposed to vote.
Absolutely. And I love that you show this through your quantitative data. So you look at, you know, different kinds of political participation. You're looking at, are they going to the panchayat? Are they contacting the elected representative? Are they doing a range of things? And you're finding, no, there are these massive, massive gender differences. And then you look at political knowledge. And then you look at political networks. And you're looking at who people spend time with, who they get their information from. And you're finding these big differences. And what I love is your point about all the different steps of the mechanisms. You know, for me, it's so important to trace each step of the causal chain. And so as men dominate a space, then they build the networks, right? They get to learn about the new things and they become regarded as knowledgeable authorities and they support each other. And this is something that I was actually, I realized a few years ago that I got wrong. So a few years ago, I did 3 months of qualitative research in rural Cambodia. Now, Cambodia is historically a matrilineal country, or some parts bilateral, and they're very supportive for women to work. So when garment factories opened up, women jumped on their scooters, they go to the factory. So it's perfectly fine for women to work, for women to mix and mingle in their public spaces. But the village cafes are an exclusively male preserve. It's just not appropriate for women to go. So they're fine for the women to work in the factories, to earn the money, to go to the fields, to go to the farm, whatever, to even to go to Phnom Penh. But the politics, the sort of status, the status work of how will we govern this society, that's for men. Because that, and that's discussed in these village cafes. Now, sometimes, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, the guys will just watch Thai boxing, right? And they'll love it and they'll get, you know, pretty rowdy. And, you know, other times they're just relaxing after being in the fields and they're having, you know, condensed milk coffees, right? So, you know, but a lot of the time, they're also sharing news on Radio Free Asia from Facebook. They're discussing about the opposition. They're discussing about this. They're learning from each other. They're building these contacts. They're hearing, you know, they've got massive problems in rural Cambodia with climate breakdown and drought and devastation. So they're organizing, well, how do we get these generators in for the water, etc.? But then they're developing the skills. They're developing the networks. They learn about it. And so I would ask women in the village, you know, what do you think about this? Oh, my husband goes. Mm-hmm. And so that was really helpful because it enabled me to sort of pull apart these two different variables. Because if I just looked at India, I might think, well, female employment is low. There's this idea of seclusion and that feeds into the male dominance of politics. But what I saw in Cambodia is it can be, you can perfectly happy to exploit women's labor, but the status job of running the show, of building those fraternal networks, of being seen as a knowledgeable authority, that can still be a male preserve.
I mean, what I think is so fascinating about that is it really highlights the importance of politics and why it would be that men would assert patriarchy more, even more so in that domain than in others. And I'm curious, I have a question for you.
Yes, go for it. Reverse podcasting now.
Did, in that case, when you saw this, was the fact that women were working weaponized against them in the sense of, you are so busy doing those things. This is our new division of labor. And so you don't need to do politics. And it's you know, empowerment in one domain is used to sort of perpetuate disempowerment in others.
So in rural Cambodia, I was looking at all different kinds of work. So for example, women going into the fields, women working in the markets, or women working in the factories. And what I found interesting is even when women were working in the factories and getting an independent wage, they would often just give it to their parents or to their husbands. And that and they would gain pride in that. And they would feel really happy to support their parents. Like, I'm able to take care of my parents, and that's a great and amazing thing. The market women were a bit more boisterous. And I think that's part of the, like, you know, there's probably some selection bias, and it's probably, you know, you develop skills on the trade. So they were a bit more rowdy. But still, you know, I did meet women who, you know, there's this one divorced businesswoman, and she had a big stall, and she was pretty boisterous. And she was, but they had this big, like, funeral procession a few years back after one person was killed associated with the opposition, and she was, you know, so there are some women who tip top she being divorced, and I thought that was important. But yeah, I think, you know, it's not necessarily the case that even if someone works, then they'll automatically question all these things, and people can just naturalize exploiting women's labor but still think, this is men's business.
This is men's business. That's how it goes with politics, you know. It's one of the things, when you look at your data, there are things that surprise you and things that you expect. And one of the things that was so surprising to me was that, I'm not going to get the exact numbers right, I'd have to look at the tables, but when you ask everyone in the village who discusses politics with whom, it's like a village of about 500 people, the most commonly named man was named by more than 100 people. And the most commonly named woman was named by like 8-10 people. And so the degree of power that comes from engaging in this political space that brings everyone into the same institution, everyone into the same space, like, it really is an intense amount of power that even, you know, I'm not diminishing the role of economic power in life. That's huge.
Yes, yes.
But, you know, everyone exists, as you said, in these different markets, in these different places. And so, you know, we're fighting for power in our job and others, and maybe we want to be richer or not. But really, with politics, there's one village where you're, like, if you hold power over that village, that's, like, an incredible sort of centralization of authority.
So I like that. So what you're saying is that, though, even if women had some sort of authority and were recognized, those networks were much smaller and much more disparate.
Yes.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
I mean, it was, I think there were two things that were interesting. Even the most connected women were still far less central, far less connected, and far more disparate than men. But then one of the things that we did was we asked about who were the most influential people, men and women. We wanted to keep it gender equal. And then we asked every person whether they had talked to those people. And of course, the men were better connected to men, and the men who we had them talk about were much better connected than the women influential leaders. But what was striking to me is that the women who had influence were better tied to men, not to women. And so anyone who sort of has political power comes to that power in the sort of status quo via men, as opposed to sort of generating a lot of power from being among women in the status quo because of the isolation that often women have.
I need to say, if anyone is interested in mixed methods, your book should be like the Bible. Because honestly, to do surveys, to do these experiments, to do the interviews, to do the network analysis, I mean, it's like ticking every single methodological book. You just assign it for like a mixed methods course as a textbook. I would. Honestly, it's amazing. Really, bravo on that. Bravo. And I think you show so how each method complements the other. So, bravo.
Thank you for that.
Okay, right. Now comes the solution.
Yeah.
So, self-help groups, I apologize. So this is for those who are not familiar, you know, these have been around, what, 40 years or so?
Yeah, since the 80s.
Right,
yeah.
And it's the idea of encouraging women to come together, usually associated with some kind of microfinance, microloan, or maybe you have a small project, run some chickens, and meet regularly. Yeah. It is a chicken thing. They often do chickens.
I have a lot of photos of myself in chicken poultry cooperatives. So yes, I laughed only because I have spent a lot of time in chicken coops. Yes.
Haven't we all? Okay. I wish we were oversharing now. Okay, so this idea that women, you know, and this has been, and a lot of people, I think, in South Asia are very fond of these, especially, you know, associated with the Grameen Bank, for example, and it's really, and it's often championed as a form of, you know, change has got to come from the bottom up, and women will get together, and they'll support each other, and they'll learn from each other.
Yeah, it's in the title.
And what happens? Tell me what happens. And how, no, tell me first, how do you find out what's going on? What are your methods here?
So I work with one NGO that mobilizes these groups. They exist, you know, at the time they existed a lot of places in India. Now they are ubiquitous all over now that the government has rolled them out through the NRLM program. But I
work, NRLM?
NRLM, the National Rural Livelihoods Mission. Yes, which is, you know, started and really amped up in the mid-2010s. And I think now that it's more than like 300 million women are members of these groups. So it has just become
300 million women are part of self-help groups.
I believe we should double check, but it is, you know.
And how is that different from Jivika?
So Jivika is one state, Bihar's program that started before NRLM and is a mission, but now they're sort of partnered together.
Okay.
And so sometimes the NRLM is the national scheme, but then different states will call their state-specific schemes.
Okay, gotcha. Because Jivika was what I went to see, and I would interview my Jivika women. Okay,
and Jivika is one of the early state programs in this space, and so informed a lot of what the national government did as they scaled up.
Okay.
I worked instead with an NGO. A lot of how I say she started actually was through NGOs. I had the privilege of working with one of the women who really started this movement, Nivedita Narayan, through Pradhan. And because NGOs operated at a smaller scale, but really like innovated in space. It also met, you know, at the time, these were groups that had been together on average 6.5 years, but ranging from like 2 to 25 years. So this is not a light touch kind of group. This isn't a set of women who've come together a few times for savings and credit and, you know, but have really a sustained weekly interaction over many, many years.
Segue, I just want to say that's brilliant because so many development intervention evaluations just look at like, you know, this started a year ago, now what's happened, right? So you're looking at something that's been in the ether, that's been going on, that's part of the ecosystem, right? So,
and it makes it, I think it's fundamental for the effects you would see. I mean, if what we're talking about is a model that relies on solidarity and collective action, that's not something that just manifests
absolutely
a few meetings. You have to really build deep trust.
Yes.
But it also makes it really hard to study methodologically. Uh-huh. And so what I do is I leverage this NGO, Pradhan, mobilized only groups in some areas, and they set a boundary around which they would identify villages they would work. And I compare women who received the Pradhan SHG program with women in villages just outside of that boundary who didn't, who ostensibly should be the same in terms of many of their characteristics, both observable and unobservable. Culture should be similar, norms should be similar because they live very close to each other.
Yes.
But only some had access to this specific SHG program. And I look at that and, you know, before I talk about what I find, part of what motivated me to do this project in the first place is, you know, as you said, many people have thought about these groups, have thought about microcredit, and almost all of the work that I had seen was really focused on the economic consequences.
Right.
Which is not surprising. They're economic groups meant to sort of improve microlending, access to savings and credit. And the results are kind of mixed.
Yes.
And maybe even lean towards not so effective at changing and transforming livelihoods, in part because of something you hinted at earlier. Often the income gets sort of directly transferred to men in the household, and often because it's not enough. And there's just a lot that goes on in this.
And I think people have also raised concern about how productive can small-scale production be, right? So there initially was this idea that if everyone gets a small loan, then maybe they'll have some chickens, but you can also get a saturated informal market, mm-hmm. that if everyone is growing chickens, then the price of chickens goes down. It's at a very simple level.
And you know, the Pradhan, the way that they do this, mm-hmm. They now have a poultry cooperative to try and create a market, but also to negotiate for better prices. And so you have to... Just having a group on its own may not be enough for exactly these reasons. The other things that people are now doing within SHGs is trying to give diversified crops so that they're more like higher agricultural yield. But the like just the group part of it has, you know, lots of, unsurprising that it would.
And I think and one thing we should also flag is that one of the reasons some people liked the idea of giving loans to women in a group was one, that women would be more dutiful, and two, that they would kind of push each other to pay back, right? So some people have criticized these microfinance companies in that relying on social pressure. Yes,
I mean, but it's directly related to what we're talking about, in that it was based on the idea that women would have more trust, mm-hmm. with each other, more solidarity with each other, that they would enforce each other's lending and payback patterns. And so I think that's why, you know, when we think about self-help groups, that's part of where that title comes from. But after seeing all of this literature, you know, it struck me, we've just talked about a world where, you know, women are very isolated. They exist mostly in the home. What does it mean not to have access to savings and credit, though of course that's an important part, but to sit every, you know, once a week in a different space and talk to women, and not just, you know, not just at the water tank where, you know, you're gossiping and socializing, but in an institutionalized structure,
yes.
that provides you a formal space to engage in politics or to engage in any kind of conversation. And so that was, I wanted to understand, does this have the capacity to change, you know, women's political outcomes?
Yes.
By enabling collective action.
Yes. I want to break this down into so many stages. So first of all, does it change their food security or their income security?
Yeah. So I find the answer is no.
Right. Okay. Next step. Does it change their gender stereotypes, their gender beliefs?
In most cases, no, it doesn't. There are a few domains in which women will articulate sort of stronger attitudes, but for the most part, it's not radically transforming their attitudes, their beliefs about the role of women in society.
Yeah, and I think this is such an important point because, I mean, the underlying assumption is that if women get together, they will develop their own independent feminist treaties and critique. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I study social change in the world, that, you know, people come to recognize women's equal competence in socially valued domains by seeing women do that, right? So you see women engineers, or you see women, you know, as part of the Indian space program doing that stuff. Yeah. And then you might think, yeah, women can do it, or women are competent because you see it, you know, seeing is believing. Mm-hmm. But if it's just a bunch of marginalized poor women getting together in a circle, it would be wild to expect that they could independently come up with their own big critique of casteist patriarchy.
I think that's, like, to put it very mildly, yes. And I mean, it goes even further. I'm jumping ahead here, but one of the things I look at is not just the impact of being in an SHG, but to compare women who are a part of SHGs in its core form versus women who are a part of SHGs that receive active trainings on gender consciousness raising. And even then, you see that it's really hard to change those attitudes.
Yes, I want to pause you there. I want to pause you there, but about the gender sensitization, because we'll get to that in a bit. That's our cliffhanger. We will come back to that. But I wanted to highlight a parallel. So after I was in India for 2 months, then I went to Uzbekistan for a month. And in Uzbekistan, female employment is that much higher. It's like 45% compared to like 25% in India. And so I was thinking, you know, I might expect, because women are mixing and mingling in the public sphere, then we might expect to see more support for gender equality. But no. You know, I was in 10 cities and villages across Uzbekistan, and I was chatting to so many different people. And of course, there's always a liberal educated elite. But beyond that, the vast majority of women just internalize the belief that you should obey your husband. You know, I spoke to super educated, articulate women in Fergana Valley, and it was the idea that no, I need to obey my mother-in-law, I need to obey my husband, and that wasn't questioned. And even I went once to a little town called Altınkul, and I was chatting to a bunch of women in their like late 30s, 40s, And they were saying, you know, marriage is tough, and they will share their marital problems. Mm. They will discuss how their husbands are being controlling, not letting them socialize, not letting them get jobs. But they'll just tell each other, "Sabre bon, be patient," or like, "This is for your own good." So, you know, just even women getting together in the public sphere, they can still reinforce these beliefs. And we shouldn't assume that women will just be, you know, feminists.
And I think this is, I'm going to highlight some of my qualitative experiences.
Please do, please do.
Perfectly. You know, because TLDR, what I find is that being a part of an SHG, you know, the women who are part of SHG are more engaged in non-electoral politics.
Ah, yes.
But, you know, and that the argument that I have is that a lot of that comes through collective action. However, I'm going to, and we can come back to that, but I want to echo what you just said, which is that I remember, you know, I spent some time going, lots of time visiting these meetings, but there was one day in particular that really stands out to me. And I went and I listened and watched a meeting happening. And afterwards we had, you know, a conversation about things. And in this first meeting, one of the women starts to share about some violence that she was experiencing in the home. And immediately she was silenced. She was told not to speak any further, like hushed. And that, you know, it was very clear to me that that's like, we don't discuss that here. We don't discuss that in front of someone else, you know, reinforcing that norm. That same.
So she was hushed by other women?
By other women in the group.
And do you think that was because they didn't want you as an outsider to hear it? Like, you know, let's present a good image of this village.
It's possible, but it was definitely clear that there was like in-group policing
happening right then and there. Yes.
And whether that was just because I'm there or whether that same pattern would exist when I leave, you know, it was, you were still sanctioned for stepping outside of whatever that normative boundary is. And that very afternoon I went to another meeting and the exact opposite happened, which is that one of the women started telling me about how one of the other women had this issue with violence in her home, but how they solved it as a group. And so really, like, you know, telling someone else's business, but also elevating the story of how this has become a space where we talk about these issues. You know, we don't say, like, in due time, it'll be fine, be patient. You know, we take care of it. And to me, I think that was one of my fundamental takeaways, is that these groups have the capacity to have transformative change via collective action, at least, you know, in the short run. Mm. But it's not a guarantee. It depends on so many different features, like how, like getting to solidarity. And how you do that is still, you know, I think a big open question. Like, what does it take for a group of women coming together to actually mean that you see yourselves as a unit with shared interests that you need to pay all the costs to collectively act and go and do that together?
I mean, you know, the much is made of the Gulubi gang, the pink gang, the women who, you know, they riled up in Uttar Pradesh, and there's this woman and she harassed the policeman for being, you know, whatever. And there's a wonderful book called Capable Women in Capable States, which I love, which is about how when women, the Indian state is systematically sexist and undercapacitated. So, you know, the police may dismiss claims, they may refuse to file the FRI, they may, the judges may ignore cases. But if women get together, if they have strong backers, then they're much more likely to get action. And I totally support that idea that you're more likely to achieve gender equitable outcomes, or you're more able to press your case if you've got strength in numbers, if you've got strong brokers, is the sort of term in India.
Yeah.
But I think for me, if I take a step back and look at the outcome, like we know from the demographic and health survey data, that of the women who have experienced domestic violence, intimate partner violence, male violence typically, very few will say, like a single digit percentages will say they have ever told anyone. Right? And I think this is part of going back to the caste system. So caste depends on women being socialized to marry and stay put. And if you cannot divorce, if you cannot leave, then what's the point in kicking up a fuss, right? It's like screaming at your boss and saying, "I hate you," but you know you've got no employment options besides that.
Well, and right along that data, the DHS also tells us that, 60% of women say that domestic violence is acceptable. So to go so far as to, you know, it's not just we won't share our experiences, but we're going to find ways to rationalize the experience of subordination of women.
Yes, I think that's such a crucial point. And so I think we can accept all this data that, you know, women may help you out and support in numbers can be really important. But systematically, there are these big, big structural forces pushing women to be quiet.
But I think, I think that that's exactly right. The issue is so deep. It's so deep. We're highlighting all the ways that it's deep. Having women support you can work, can help, but it may not.
Mm.
And B, if it does, it may not look the way we expect it to. It may not look like all of us updating our attitudes or even all of us, you know, wanting to engage in this. It could look like, you know, a couple of very strong women enforcing collective action on the group. Or, you know, because at the end of the day, women are incredibly diverse
sure.
in their needs, their experiences, their beliefs, all of these things that are so deep rooted. You know, one of the villages I spent time in that where this group had started to make demands on the state, the way that they did it, it was clear. There was the leader of the SHG went before the village meeting to every woman's house and pulled her out of her home, whether she wanted to go or not, and said, it's time, we're going to the meeting, and here are the demands that we're going to make. And so I say all of that to say that I think it provides an institutional structure that allows you to challenge patriarchal spaces, especially when those spaces are likely to resist you entering them. And so it's necessary to have a collective support to challenge that, but it may not be sufficient because there's so many barriers to doing that. And even so many barriers, once you do that, to having a shared set of demands that you would raise in these spaces.
Yes. And I think one also important point to think about, going back to your point about this being patrilocal, is that women as a group don't necessarily have shared interests. So if you're a mother-in-law, or if you're a woman who, you know, if you feel that, you know, the monsoon rains are incredibly dangerous, treacherous, you've got massive economic insecurity, then you are hugely reliant on your jati, and you may not want some young woman to be rocking the boat, pursuing a love marriage or pushing back against some kinship relationship. So there may be some issues where women can find solidarity. Like, they may all want more piped water, right? That, you know, so women might find common ground in piped water, because that's not, you know, disrupting the existing systems. So they could come together for that reason. Then we brought the next question about how men react.
Yeah.
Now tell me about this, because this is the big thing which your work is so important in showing.
You know, it's and I think it builds so much off of what you just said, that there is, I really like Molyneux's framework.
Aha, Maxime Molyneux, right.
Yes. And I think, you know, we've got the set of interests that women may share because of the gender system, things like it's our job to collect piped water.
Yes, these are her practical gender interests.
Practical interests. And then there's the set of shared interests because we are suppressed by the gender system. So things like challenging violence, and this, in the context I work, a lot of it is around seeking prohibition because alcohol's linked to violence. And
yes.
And that was one of the most common things, other than piped water, other than other development outcomes, that would bring women together. So, you know,
all women were uniting to push for prohibition.
Prohibition, yeah. In fact, in Bihar, you know, Jivika Sen is one of the big drivers of prohibition in Bihar.
You know, in Indian data, it shows that a woman is 3 times more likely to be beaten up by her husband if he drinks.
I mean, this is the qualitative understanding. I didn't know that from the data. It's very interesting.
Alcohol abuse is a major driver of patriarchy. Domestic violence, absolutely. And obviously, there are factors that will make men, certain kinds of men, more likely to drink, right? So there could be a bit of like an erratic or unstable man abuses alcohol and then he beats up his wife. But even if you're erratic, once you've drunk alcohol, then it's going to be much, much worse. And it's not just that he's more likely to beat his wife, but there's more likely to be severe injuries, etc. And you know, I do not know what the solution is, and I'd be grateful to know if you have any ideas on what the solution is, because, you know, so many people, and this is another tangent, but, you know, so many people have raised concerns about the sort of Baptist and bootleggers idea that once you prohibit things, then you get criminal gangs, then you get, you know, all kinds of...
I mean, even separate from that, we have several states in India that have prohibited alcohol, Bihar being one of them, and yet I just finished a survey in Bihar, and we, you know, there were several villages that we could not collect data in because the amount of alcoholism was so extreme that we couldn't actually enter, and alcohol was such a dominant market within those communities in a state where it's been prohibited.
Well, wait, slow down, lady. You couldn't enter? What do you mean?
What I mean by that is that there would be too much threat to our enumerators because of the instability of people in the village, either because there were two, you know, different kinds of villages like this. And we assessed it ahead of time. We didn't, you know, send people in to assess this. But, you know, in one case, there were people just on the street roaming around, and we could not ensure the protection of people, given that there were some sort of, like, it was a village known for having some, like, conflict because of alcoholism. And in the other, I think more telling, the market for alcohol was so strong that it was known that there was like infighting in the village between people and the market sellers of the alcohol. And, you know, we were cautious. We didn't want to send anyone somewhere where there was any chance of risk. And, you know, hearing that this often led to conflict in these villages, and not just conflict, violent conflict, you know, all to say that, you know, alcohol, I'm not surprised that it would be, that there's evidence to suggest it's linked with violence. But also, again, prohibition doesn't mean no alcohol. Mm. You know, it means no legal alcohol.
Yes, yes.
And often, you know, this is a context where, in fact, it created even stronger vested interests in this.
Do you know what the Alice Evans approach to this would be? That I will definitely strap from this podcast. You know, I would be curious to see. And the question is, how do you get people to do this on a voluntary basis? But an equivalent of Ozempic, such that, you know, some people drink alcohol and they don't want to be alcohol dependent.
Yeah, true.
Right? There are lots of people who they can struggle with work, they can start drinking, and then they get into a cycle of dependency because it's a drug. And I would like to, and I would be curious to see what happens if you can make cheaply available drugs so that people, if they want to, can leave this very, can be a horrific, horrific relationship that I saw certainly in Russia, in Poland, etc. That, you know, it decimates men's lives and then their families in turn. And I think, you know, technology is a massively underrated way of addressing many social issues that we as social scientists have failed to, you know, we can try with prohibition, we can try with campaigns or women's collective action, but many of them don't have the desired impact.
Yeah.
And technology, like some version of Ozempic. Anyway.
I mean, if there's a way, you know, it's, you know, it's a disease, and if there's a way to, like, cure that,
the public health response. The public health response.
It is. I mean, all of this is a public health issue, violence against public health, you know.
Yes.
And so, yeah.
But if it's to a level where you as a researcher would be nervous to send numerators into a place because of too much violence associated with
alcohol.
Alcohol. Yeah. Yeah, wow.
It's, you know.
So the women were complaining about alcohol in their SHGs, in the self-help groups?
So the SH, yeah, they in the groups, they were complaining about alcohol. And, you know, in fact, it's like the, apart from water, it's the most common thing that I see them collectively act on, is trying to gain more prohibition. In fact, in one of the areas, they ran an entire prohibition rally across multiple villages to try to, you know, call for reductions in alcohol consumption.
Do you think the self-help group enabled women to recognize that as a shared grievance, like what Molyneux would call a strategic gender interest? Yes.
And the evidence I have to support that is that when you look at what women articulate as the biggest problem, even women who are in self-help groups, very few articulate that as the biggest problem. But when you look at what women in self-help groups collectively act for, it is like, it's the second most common thing. It's piped water and it's prohibition.
Wait, slow down. So you're saying if you ask people what are your big concerns, they won't necessarily say it. But if you look at their revealed preferences in terms of what they actually do, they act on alcohol.
Yes. And when
what would explain that disparity?
Particularly their revealed preference in what they're acting, when they're acting with other women. And so to me, in the process of negotiating collective action, it emerges as the shared interest that would get women to collectively act together. Because the collective action for alcohol is conditional on collective action. So given that women have found, you know, a way to engage, you know, to against the state, this is what they find. Whereas something like what are the things they most commonly name as big problems? Schools, mm-hmm. healthcare. Those are things that they're not using these spaces to make traction on those issues. They're using these spaces to make traction on issues like alcoholism.
And I think, so I spent a year in Zambia, in the Zambian Copperbelt. What I saw is that when women started to sell in the market, so this is like, you know, an informal, very saturated market. Women are earning very, very low wages. They're reselling things they bought in Tanzania or South Africa. So they're not earning a high wage. But the importance of that being in the market is they're building friendships with other women and they're sharing their personal stories. And I think in a patriarchal context, you know, there's a lot of gaslighting going on, right? So if a man starts beating a woman, he may tell her, oh, it's your fault. You know, you are nagging me. You are hassling me. Why are you such a difficult woman? And she internalizes it and she sees it as her fault. And so she thinks, you know, tomorrow she's just going to be sweeter, to be nicer, to be more accommodating. And she's getting all these patriarchal messages that it's her fault. And that's hard to shake off. But when women do get together, they may, if you hear multiple women saying, you know, my husband beat me up, and then you realize that, you know, you can listen to her story with perhaps more, sometimes, not necessarily, but sometimes more impartiality and thinking, well, didn't really sound like her fault. And these women do come to recognize men as a source of that problem. That, and I think that, you know, that, and many people, many listeners may take this for granted, but And I'm sure I've seen it in Mexico, I've seen it in Uzbekistan. So often male violence is blamed on women's bad behavior. And it takes a big cognitive shift for women to see that actually the person who is abusing it is the perpetrator.
I mean, this is what that DHS data tells us. It's, you know, when I say that 60% of women say it's acceptable for men to for domestic violence against women, it's always the way that the question is framed is, if the woman didn't make
clear, yes, if she burns the food, if she goes out without permission, etc. Yes.
And so, you know, that's very clear evidence of the internalization that it's my fault.
Yes.
Not necessarily internalization that violence is okay, but that it's my fault that I experienced it. And to me, you know, we're talking about what could be, what is the value of these groups. I think it's exactly what you articulated. It is women seeing that their experience where they thought it was their fault is a more common one. And, you know, as you said, it's so much easier for us to give advice to our friends, you know, or to empathy and compassion for our friends. And so you hear other people going through it and you're like, okay, A, I'm not alone.
Yes.
You know, and B, this doesn't make sense to me through the framework that I'm used to applying. And so you start to challenge some of those ideas, and it may not translate into a deep change in your internalized belief. That's hard, but it might say, okay, we could do something about this acute issue that's harming my friend or a set of my friends, and use the space that we have in that way.
And I'll tell you a parallel in the West. So I've interviewed women who are in male-dominated workspaces, for example, in tech. And so women in finance or women in tech may say, you know, my code was constantly doubted and I thought it was a problem with me. But then there was another woman in that same room and they were treating her in the same way. And it was only the two of us that were being given that sexist treatment. And I started to realize it wasn't about me and my code. They were just being sexist. Sometimes it takes, you know, people, you know, can blame themselves, etc.
Which, I mean, it gets to a question you asked, how do men respond? And, you know, what I see is that in not all instances, there, in fact, you know, there's a varied set of responses.
Right.
But one of the sets of responses that women experience is the second they try to challenge things, and by challenge things, I mean either demand things that men don't want, like prohibition of alcohol, or demand that they should have a voice. That in and of itself is a major challenge to the patriarchal order. They resist it. They challenge it, often very violently. What I see is that women are more likely to experience public shaming and humiliation, more likely to note being afraid when they have gone through empowerment programs. And, you know, when you see this, I think it becomes so much clearer in the qualitative data. Women describe information control happening more, being denied access to information about when public meetings are going to happen, or when, you know, what are the key sources of politics and or sort of what's going on in the community. They're also the backlash that they receive happens through the men in their family, where their husbands are shamed by other men.
Yes.
So that they will then pass that back into the home itself. And then women, of course, experience the same, you know, not just, again, violence, humiliation, but attempts to reassert what you're saying, what you're describing in the home around violence, women being told, well, this is your fault, shame on you, you know, you could have, and, you know, thinking I could have done better. The same thing happens when women try to get access to public spaces, saying, like, this is not your place. Why are you here? I mean, one of the quotes that just really sticks mm-hmm. with me is that a woman said, she shared with me that when she tried to go to a public meeting, I mean, we're talking about her trying to go to a community meeting to make a demand for a public service, you know, That's what we're talking about. The men said to her, is it that all of the men in the village are dead? Is that why you are here? Like, because they could not fathom that a woman would show up in this space when there were still men alive. Mm. And that's a way of shaming her into thinking you're not supposed to be mm-hmm. here. Like, what's wrong with you? And really trying to reinforce those norms. And so one of the sort of dominant responses that you see to women gaining empowerment, women gaining access to politics, is the reassertion of the patriarchal order in an attempt to suppress that process of renegotiating norms.
And I want to add in two really important mechanisms that you highlight in your book. Is one is this idea that of men's status depending on them being the ones organizing politics and them being the head of the household. And so if a woman is uppity, or if a woman pushes to get into that political domain, then it's humiliating. It shows her husband has not got her under proper control. And then this is reinforced through, one, men as a collective fraternal group, and then also within the household level. So one parallel, to go back to Uzbekistan, like in the 1920s, the Soviet Union had this hujum campaign where they were trying to encourage women to throw off their hijabs, or their paranjis is what it's called in Uzbekistan. And after the women unveiled, 2,000 women were killed. Oof. Killed by members of their own family, because it was an idea, it was designed to terrify all women so that they would not dare do it in order to maintain men's status, and women terrify women to push back women back into the home. So what you're seeing in India about, you know, humiliation, that is, you know, this part of the system of pushing women, you know, basically it's enforcing. You know, I think you see these two mechanisms of male dominance, of patriarchal dominance, and either women are kept in the home, or if they step out, if they challenge that, there's this violent pushback.
Exactly right. Which is, that's exactly what I see happening. And I think what it reveals is that it reveals that in the places where women haven't pushed back, that this is the mechanism maintaining the system of control.
Yes.
And, you know, women are incredibly smart. They know what's going to happen. And so it's only when you have the capacity to challenge that you would even attempt to do so.
Yes. And there's a parallel in the labor market. So there's this paper by Reed, came out a few years ago. It shows that women who are most likely to report frequent and severe violence in India are those who earn more than their husbands. Mm. Right? Challenging the patriarchal order.
Wow.
I mean, that's why I like to look at all these different domains sort of together, violence, politics, labour market, because it's the exact same things that you talk about in every single domain, And now you mentioned, and this is the gender sensitization. So you look at this fantastic programme, you look at the best case example of sensitization, because there's a lot out there. You know, some are sort of super crappy and done on the cheap, but like I've been in Zambia to like an assertiveness training where it's just like writing on the board what assertiveness is, right? So there's a big spectrum, and you look at like the gold standard gender sensitization. Tell me about this.
Yeah, it was a program put together in partnership with the Pradhan, the NGO I work with, and a feminist NGO named Jaggery that really spent years designing this program that has, like, you know, it's years of trainings and interventions, and it's incredibly collaborative. You know, one of the activities that I really like actually gets to this labor market, sort of the relationship between all of these things, has women, there's a pile of rocks in the middle of the room and a scale. And it asks women to talk through everything that they do over the course of a day that benefits the family, and to choose a rock in proportion to the scale of effort that activity takes. and they fill up one side of the scale, and then they do the same thing for men on the other side. And you can imagine what the scale looks like at the end. You know, often women have exerted substantially more effort to benefit the family.
It's so nice.
And then they have a conversation about why is women's work valued differently.
That's amazing.
Than it is for men.
See, if you just told me the story of that sensitization, I'd be like, bravo, go for it. Take all my money. Because that gets into something real. Like, there's a really nice 2012 paper by Boudet et al. Called Gender Norms. It's published by the World Bank. And they show that systematically women's work is devalued, not necessarily recognized as work. You know, throughout the world, women do enormously valuable contributions, household survival, GDP, etc. But they just don't see it.
Yeah.
So, yes. So that sensitization thing sounds great.
It's, you know, it is. In fact, you know, we can. I'll tell you about what I study. In the book, I study the pilot program. But following that, because this program seemed to have real power behind it, you know, we've now scaled it up, systematized it. And are just wrapping up a randomized evaluation of it. And so I'm really excited that sometime this year we'll know even more nuance of how it worked because, you know, we had a bit more sort of understanding of how things go.
I've never been more excited about rocks.
Exactly. Exactly. But so what happened in... So what I do is I compare SHGs that didn't have this program and SHGs that did have this program. And what you find is, again... sort of nuanced experiences. Women are much more likely to collectively act after the gender sensitization program. They're much more likely to access political spaces, but their attitudes are fairly unchanged, which is surprising
given
the core of this program. They, in fact, they report lower levels of interest in politics. And, you know, they experience substantial levels of backlash from men, more so than women who aren't in, who don't receive the gender sensitization program because of this. And I actually see all of these in tandem with each other. I mean, this is mostly from the qualitative source material behind it, but which is that women knew they were doing things that were norm deviant. They knew that just experiencing this program was norm deviant, and they did so in a safe space. And then they leveraged their collective to go and make demands in public spaces. But then in private spaces, they faced a lot of threat for that norm deviance. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's quite possible that the attitude, the non-change in attitudes and the retrenchment in political interest are a form of... backlash, I'm putting this in quotes, y'all can't see my hands, which is, I'm going to look more like a norm-abiding woman to counteract the norm-deviant behavior that I'm doing in this other domain, you know, which there's a, I think Jessica Gottlieb has this fantastic paper on a program in Mali that shows exactly this, that when women went through a civics education program, they... in the opposite happened. They became less likely to engage in politics because they had to counteract what they had done in public spaces.
And to be clear, this norm deviant sort of correction behavior is not unique to Mali or India. So I was just at Barnard where Corinne Lowe, an economist, presented a paper showing that, you know, when women out-earn their husbands, they might do more domestic work, right? Mm. Pampering his ego so that he feels more of a man, right? The man gets served at home, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
That's my impression of a man, right? But yeah, I think this is a common thing. So patriarchy is the idea that men have high status and women have low status. And if you rock the boat, then he may feel more uncomfortable. And she may also, you know, if women internalize these patriarchal beliefs, she may want to pump him up, so to speak.
Yeah. And, you know, and you see the consequence of not. You see that they face more active backlash from men inside their home, outside in the community, as you mentioned. But then they probably are experiencing less of that because they're pumping up men, creating, so reestablishing the status differential between
men
and women.
Yes, exactly. So how do you interpret this data? So if you see data that self-help groups, gender sensitization can lead to this patriarchal backlash, what does that make you think about these interventions?
You know, it's complicated. I think it makes me think three things. One, the problem is hard and that there's not a silver bullet. And we so often want there to be a silver bullet to gender inequality that, you know, if we just find something that we can, you know, implement everywhere, it'll work and then things will look better. Time and time again, the large scale, widespread interventions have some positive effects, but then don't radically change things. And I think that that's true in this case. Mm. These are deep rooted problems, and the process of getting to change is not going to be linear.
Mm.
So that's the first thing I take away. The second thing that I take away is that I think more work is needed in this space. So this is an idea, not a definitive answer, but that it might be that true progress on these issues comes with some form of backlash. And so that needs to be, if that's the case, because at the end of the day, we're challenging status and power. Mm, and so what does it mean to challenge status and power without some form of backlash? We need to think about how we design programs to protect from it.
But how could you, what, like, for just to push back on that.
Yeah.
So I think for as long as, if men are doing the sort of socially valued work and people have these status beliefs that men are dominant and men should be providers and men are protectors and it's a patrilineal system, what would you do in a program that would prevent pushback?
So,
like, suppose you had millions, like, I can't think of what, if I had infinite money, I wouldn't know what to do.
So I think that there's, you know, there's, and I'm not going to make a normative statement because I think it's complicated. Mm. I think there's a difference between preventing it and protecting against when it does happen.
Mm.
So where I think we've seen some examples of how, I don't know that they're scalable programs, but of how you can prevent it, would be you find a way to align men's incentives with women's.
Mm-hmm.
You find a way to make whatever the behavior is socially acceptable. So for example, there's a recent dissertation by Anirvan Chaudhary out of Berkeley on women's political participation in the BJP in India. And what he shows is how the BJP reframes women's political participation as being about service to the community, seva. And, you know, I think part of what that is making it so that men find it acceptable. It's good to men for women to do this. I think the paper by Ali Chima and
Wait, let me just pick up on that. I think that's such a nice point there. And there are two bits of research showing that.
Mm.
So Cecilia Ridgway, in her wonderful book, Status, she makes this point that if men are high status then and women are low status, then women, when they're contributing to the group and are seen as nice, then it's more acceptable. Exactly. So you've got to do a lot of work making everyone clear that I'm contributing to the group, I'm being nice, everyone is benefiting from my efforts. And also there's some new work in the US showing that women are more likely to run for politics if it's seen not as individual ambition and status, but as serving the broader community. And interestingly, in Sweden, for example, where it's a proportional representation and a politician is not a big status individual like a governor, but rather a spokesperson for their party and serving the collective. Mm. You know, the way that people see these different ambitions, both women and men, could make a difference. So if you're seen as doing something good for the group, like voting for the household, right? Yes.
Or in this case, I think, you know, I haven't differentiated it, but we could, in the data that I have, the women who articulate, you know, in the qualitative data, the women who articulated a desire for development as opposed to a desire for prohibition and protection and empowerment, you know, you see men are saying SHGs are good. They bring development.
Mm, mm.
But lurking behind all of that is them saying women's empowerment is not threatening.
Right, yes, yes.
And when it's made less threatening, it doesn't mean that there's not a pathway to real change there. It's just potentially a quite slow one because you're finding,
I'm normalizing something of being seen as a team player.
Exactly.
Like, for example, in Argentina, the very first feminist activists were the women of the square. So the mothers who protested against their sons' disappearances during the dictatorship. And it was legitimate for women to do that because they were acting as mothers, right? So they were protecting protesting their last sons. And that has been part of a long-going sort of 40-year process of women's political. So do you observe less patriarchal backlash if they're asking for water as opposed to prohibition?
I see that in the qualitative data. I don't know systematically. Mm-hmm. It's hard with the data that I have. It's certainly something that should be explored more deeply. Mm-hmm. But in the qualitative data, you know, I talked about how the common response of men was backlash, but there's also another response of men, which is some version of like allyship, but it's really more like aligned interests. And, you know, when they see what women are doing in these groups as good, then they get on board with them. Mm. They don't lash back against them. They support them. And that never happens when it's about prohibition, alcohol, violence, protection. It's when it's, well, they're bringing water to the community. Yes. So they've done good. They've improved the schools. They've got the teachers to come. That's good. You know, in fact, what they're doing is freeing up space that men don't have to worry about the politics of public services. They yes. can think about politics as power.
Let me give you two more examples. Do you know one of my favorite books in India? Mm. Shiv Sena Women by Aatri mm. Sen. I love that. Mm. And it's all about these Hindu nationalist women from a very poor slum. And, you know, these women are aggressive, they're violent, they're Islamophobic, but it's supported by the broader community because it's part of that mm. Hindu nationalist cause, right? Mm. And I think a similar example would be women working as part of the Muslim Brotherhood, whether in Egypt, for example. You know, these foot soldiers are accepted because it's furthering the group. And, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood may accept women to be working because they can connect to other women, for example. So you can be, as long as you're a team player, the patriarchy will welcome you.
Exactly. The way to prevent backlash mm. is to mm. work within the system, work within patriarchy. And maybe, you know, that will move the outcomes we care about. Like, it might get women to show up to public meetings. It might get women to vote more. It might get women in the labor market more. Mm. But we can question, is that
important? I want you to come back on this podcast with more data as to whether it's possible to be a team player but still even to turn up, you know, because yeah. maybe there's a binding constraint and it's just women turning up at these meetings.
Yeah.
You know, for example, in Pakistan, there are villages where all men have made a collective agreement not to let women vote.
I mean, I've seen that in many of the villages, not around voting, mm. but around showing up at these right. meetings. So it's not clear that they're, you mm. know, I think it depends on how you get men on board with it.
Yes.
But you're right. It's not clear that even that's enough.
Yes.
I mean, you know, but to get to the core question, is there a way for women to challenge patriarchy as opposed to operate from within it without experiencing backlash?
Mm.
It's not clear to... I haven't seen that yet. Mm. I'd be curious if others mm. have seen interventions. And so I think there many would say you shouldn't have those programs. Mm. If they're going to lead to backlash. But my response is these women mm. want it. They know what they're getting into. And they still choose to collectively act.
What happens after they've been humiliated? Do they get quieter?
In some cases, yes. But in some cases, no. They push back. They keep fighting. They mobilize more support. They build institutions. They, you know, continue to try to make traction. Now, but that, I think, reveals what it means to actually protect from backlash. It's to enable women's sustenance, their mm. ability to sustain through that backlash and have, mm. you know, spaces and support structures. I think part of what, some of what they leverage, you know, again, with SHGs, there's a lot of mixed stuff, mm. but they have, they're federated structures. So it's not just one SHG operating. They can then go to the village organization and then the cluster federation mm. organization and then the federation, and they could build a larger group of
having
women
backup these
that
brokers.
Can help them in those situations.
Mm. Mm.
Using it in that way is a hard way to do it, but I think part, like, that structure is one protection mechanism that women can, like, use to support them.
Do you see any difference of in Madhya Pradesh, what percentage of these women have, like, smartphones and access to sort of digital networks?
Smartphones is very few. Mm. Phones is like 20%.
Mm. Mm.
I mean, it's shocking. We just did a survey of women panchayat leaders, mm. the sarpanch.
Yes.
Not even 50% of them have phones.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's very low.
I have a question. Do you see any differences? I know you don't find any differences by caste. I recall that. Do you see any differences by religion in your data?
I wish I could. Mm. The places that I look are largely tribal, and there just are no... There's not... The religious diversity is tribal versus not. It's not... There are very few Muslim women.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here is one more question. Suppose you had $500 million
hmm.
to promote gender equality. So if you could run some intervention, you had $500 million, what would you do?
You know, I don't think it's going to be an answer many people would like.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would invest it in whatever, like, I would work within and try to identify local NGOs that have really worked on this problem. Mm. And I would invest in letting groups that know the context deeply mm-hmm. Do what they know best. With so all of that to say, I think it's hard for me to my takeaway from my work is that it would be hard for me to articulate this is the thing I would do.
Oh, right, definitely right. So your idea is that the local groups will have better knowledge of local priorities and we should defer to them. Here's an idea. So going back to your idea that patriarchs may prefer team players, how much confidence would you have, like, if women's groups were seen achieving something?
Yeah.
So there's this paper by Acemoglu and others, and they show that successful democracies breed their own support. So this is at the national level, right? So if you have a democracy and they produce public goods mm-hmm. and they produce economic growth, then people living under those regimes are much more likely to support democracy. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have an electoral democracy and there's crap growth and there's crap public services, then people are like, hey, actually, I'd rather have an autocrat. I want a big, strong leader. And so I think the implication of that paper is that, like, people are more likely to support something and see it as beneficial when they have personally benefited from it.
Yeah.
And this goes back to our idea that, you know, you might want a team player. So I wonder if there's something that would not just a matter of supporting women's groups, but supporting effective women's groups.
Yes.
So, for example, suppose there was funding, like, suppose there was something that enabled women's groups to organize generators or whatever it is in that local issue. If women's groups were seen doing stuff, seen achieving things that people value, right? You know, we can't, you know, I think at scale, it's unlikely to get everyone to do the rock game, right? But you could,
yeah.
You know, you could.
The government's working, the government's trying.
Right. But you could, but if there was something that people would actually see women doing socially valuable stuff. Now, you know, that could be jobs, employment, or it could be, is this, or, you know, I wonder if that's another way to think about it. How would you make women's groups more effective in doing what people value? Right? It's not enough, you know, women shouting and saying, I want stuff, but let people see. And, you know, that might not even necessarily have to be on the ground. You know, maybe we spend our 500 million and we ask Shah Rukh Khan and others to make a cool Bollywood show where women's groups are achieving stuff, right? And people are like, wow, these women can achieve stuff and it's great and everyone benefits. And the melodrama is about how amazing it is and the whole community thrives. That is my Bollywood answer. No.
So my answer is going to be very different.
Okay, go for it.
Not because I don't think that could work.
Okay.
Because I do think that would have power. But I think mine, I'm going to give you my dream and then I'm going to give you what I'm working on now.
Oh, okay.
A teaser. so I think some of what I would, I think there are a lot of programs now that are actually doing what you described, which is putting women's groups in charge of public service delivery. And I think a benefit of that is that it will have this cascade effect of revealing to communities that women's groups are providing goods to the community. I mean, for example, during the pandemic, they were put in charge of the creation of PPE and other information.
Was that a government initiative?
It was.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, I think that hasn't been studied systematically, but I think that that is happening. What I would add to it, though, is I would insulate the women's group in some way, because right now, often what's happening is the groups are being told what to do, as opposed to, you know, being given grants to go do what they want. I mean, we'd have to think about the community-driven development literature and the challenges there. But, you know, there has to be a way to insulate groups to allow them to continue to be self-help instead of government help groups, but also, you know, bring things to their communities. Now, what I'm working on now, which is not quite as big as that, but is, you know, India has these, it's a deep problem, what we're talking about.
Yes.
It is really hard to solve, but one of the things that India has done is two of the largest women's equality programs, attempts at women's equality programs in the world.
Mm.
We have reservations for women in local office at incredible scale. Millions of women elected.
Yes.
And now we have hundreds of millions of women in self-help groups.
Yes.
And those are, like, the fact that they exist as institutions provide an opportunity set as a starting point.
Mm.
And so what we're doing is we're looking at how do you combine these two? How do you link women's groups to the panchayat system, create better feedback loops between them so that women can make their demands to the people who have power to make them happen. But also, how do you get these people in power to see women's groups as a constituency that they should respond to, and whether that could possibly change the dynamics of politics and output. We'll see. Big questions, but
See, I'm still skeptical on that mechanism, because when I was in rural Bihar, and again, my experience in India is far less than yours. You know, there was a female sub-panch, and and I was with the Jivika group, and yet, when I asked that group, has any woman ever left this village for work?
No.
I mean, it was the women were getting together, the sub-panch was there, but it's...
So I should say, I'm... In fact, I could go even further than you. I'm very skeptical of the individual part of this. You know, one of the things... Have you engaged in any of your work with the concept of a sarpanch pathi or?
Yes.
So, you know, this is something many people know about. Mm. In case people here don't, it's the idea that, you know, women who are elected in the system often serve as proxies for their husbands. I mean, not that different a story than what I've been telling you about voting at home.
It's the centrality of the household.
You know, we don't have a lot of systematic data on this, and so we just finished a survey in both Gujarat and an MP. And what we found is that 75% of these women elected representatives say that their male family member has more say over their job than they do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge issue. The challenge of like how you overcome that. But, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is figure out, can you have elected women SHGs? Are there ways that you can create more empowerment at both levels and build networks? I mean, my theory of change, we'll see if it pans out, but is that, you know, horizontal and vertical networks are going to be critical to help insulate and protect and create information flows and change that really complicated network structure. Is it going to be enough? I don't know.
See, for me, you know, I think that even if you build the networks, as long as the vast majority of people, one, internalize these status beliefs that men are high status, two, anticipate that others will judge them and disapprove of them if they do not have status, then you will see this collective enforcement and you have this collective pushback. And so the question for me is fundamentally cultural. Like, how do you encourage people to believe, how do men come to believe that they will not be shamed? So this is a wonderful book, this guy, Chowdhury, it's called City of Men. Mm-hmm. It's about Bihari migrants who go to Calcutta. And, like, you know, they're so worried about shame and policing and stigma in their community that they don't bring their wives to Calcutta. Their wives stay in the village and they're very careful about their conduct because they're worried about shame. You know, how do people come to believe that actually they will be supported and respected if they are a dual earning household and they're thriving together as a couple? You know, for me, and that's why I come back to these Bollywood films. How do you change people's aspirations? Because clearly they can change. So, for example, and I think this stat is important, in England, in the UK, British Indian women work at almost exactly the same rate as native British women, right? So even first generations work. So Indian culture can change, right? Hindu culture can change. And so culture is malleable and it's not static. And it's the question of how do people come to believe? And it's a collective action, right? Everyone has to jump together, right? Yeah. So you have to believe that everyone in your village will be supportive of you and your wife working and thriving in partner together.
Yeah.
And I think that if people are still worried about shame and stigma, and, you know, in an Indian society where everyone is incredibly concerned about, you know, not wanting to stick their neck out, you know, wanting to go with a herd because they're dependent on each other, rely on each other, care about wider social approval, you know, how do you overcome some of those collective action problems culturally? I think is part of it as well.
I mean, I think it's a huge part of it. And so I definitely am in agreement with you. I think where I don't disagree, but struggle is that, you know, even in context, like, you know, we're sitting here in Palo Alto, even here, you know, where the attitudes and the norms and the beliefs look very different, there's still incredible constraints. And, you know, patriarchy looks different, but still operates. And so, you know, what would be the solution here? And to me, the atomization of women and the fact that you know, gender is this cross-cutting identity.
For sure.
This is why I keep coming back to the household. Mm. You know, households are often spaces of identity sharing.
Mm.
And yet gender is the thing that cuts across it, which makes it so hard
yes.
for women to come together. And so, you know, I think that it's just such a complicated story that you're right. It needs norm shift and attitudinal and norm shift. But then also, you know, is even that enough? You know, how do you... How do you get rid of the deep roots?
Okay, I have one more question.
Yeah.
Professor Brilliman. Okay. When, after you've done more of this research on India, will you please come back on this podcast? Because you have been an absolute delight. And I love, love, love your book, The Patriarchal Political Order. And it's been a real, real pleasure listening to you, learning from you. And I just want you to come back and share more with us.
It would be my absolute pleasure. This has just been so much fun. So thank you for having me.
Okay, everybody, this is the King Center of International Development at Stanford University. Professor Prilliman's book is The Patriarchal Political Order. It is super fantastic, and I commend it to you all. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.